Welcome to Cavaliers Break Bad, the big ass Breaking Bad podcast that's as unofficial as they come.
Right on.
Yep. All right. So today we are looking at the second part of season two where shit really gets real. And I guess before I start off, I just have to say, because of spoiler etiquette, that we will be spoiling not just these episodes, but the entire series up to 508, because if you were listening to this in the present, in which case, hi future, then obviously the last eight episodes are yet to air, which we will come to in the near future to dissect live. But let's jump into episode 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 of season 2.
Starting with...
Well, first of all, I just want to say that kind of as we came to a close of season two, it kind of confirmed what I had long thought, that Breaking Bad season two has a good claim of being Breaking Bad's best season.
Yeah, and particularly considering how real it gets, it is a big call, but having just sat through it again, that's a... I could that could sit well with me, maybe. Once we rewatch all of them, I might have something to say about it, but at the moment, that's pretty... I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, season one it improved on rewatch, but season two, I remember being amazing, and I remember always thinking of as one of the best seasons, and going back pretty much confirmed that. And mainly, the thing that it benefits from so much is that you see the results of the writers actually planning it all out from the start, which all is around the pink bear. But as I was watching ABQ just recently, it really all clicked into place how structured this whole thing has been, even though it didn't feel like sort of one artificial contrived arc.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe from around about the end of episode 10 over, that is some of the just the most unabatedly brilliant storytelling you're going to find anywhere.
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane.
It just... And,
I mean, of course, we're gonna get to that in due course and just have a really great time just crapping on about how amazing that is.
Yeah. So, I mean, previously on Breaking Bad, we end with Negro Azul, which basically is kind of like the... ultimate. It's where things start shifting into gear, in that we meet Jane, we kind of get hints about the cartel, Jesse and Walt are starting to expand their meth operation, exponential growth, layered like nachos. And then 208 is the introduction of Saul Goodman, who may be getting his own show.
Which is... brilliant,
yeah.
On all counts, because and this episode, kind of rewatching this episode, you're like, yep, no, I'm happy with that. When you see his clientele, and also there's another moment. I think I just in the general kind of context of this episode, his presence is kind of there from the beginning, literally, because Badger, of course, the cold open for this episode, one of my favorites
is because it's this long static take.
Which is always fine by me, but it's Badger sitting on a bench when some just skinny dude comes up to him, sits down on the bench beside him, and of course,
skinny but not as tall as Skinny Pete himself.
But yeah, absolutely. So the thing is, you're kind of thinking, is he a cop? Is he just another customer? But of course, the thing is, he's a cop, and that puts Badger in the shit, and just shows Badger to be the absolute.
Yeah.
Dumbass that he is. But at the very beginning of that, on the bench, Badger is sitting in front of a Better Call Saul advertisement, which I think is a very nice touch. That's what brings him in.
Well, no, what's brilliant is that you've got... the way they frame it is you see Better Call Saul on the bus, and when Badger stands up and when he's arrested, Saul looks directly at the camera just before we get, so you know, like, you're done, you're in prison, and then Saul's just staring at the camera, you know, going, Better Call Saul.
And then
as soon as the credits
it goes straight into his ad. But also another great moment of that cold open is he's like, yeah man, come on, I smell bacon, that brown van, like, and he's like pointing at these two brown vans, which then just pull up, like
I know,
like, after, flower shop.
Yeah, one's like, a brown van, you know. piano and one's a flower shop, and he's talking about how cliched it is and how obviously you can pick it.
And this, they just the shot where they pull up is just complete like cliche, like simultaneously two vans on either side just arrive right there. It's a genius. It's so good.
Yeah, he falls for it immediately. what I love is as soon as that happens, like, you've been kind of going, this guy looks really fucked up. The actual detective who captures him, the really skinny guy. Yeah. And as soon as Saul enters, he immediately says, you know, you look about 12. So, yeah, no, I think that whole opening is really brilliant.
Yeah, I think really this episode, rewatching it now with the knowledge of the potential, say, for Better Call Saul as a show, you kind of view this almost as a pilot.
Yeah.
And as far as pilots go, it's pretty good.
It's like it's a backdoor pilot.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so good.
Yeah, because there's this whole, when we see Jesse and Walt in Saul's waiting room, there's just like this whole, like, there's a story with every one of those people, you know, like the biker with the neck brace.
And the dude with the seven screaming kids as well.
Yeah, it's all these kind of weird characters, and you imagine there's a story here.
And that's the thing, like, you kind of see it and you think episodic or serial. I think Better Call Saul could be something that really could play with that.
I think it should be episodic because, I mean, we just kind of assume that good television has to be serialized.
I mean, you're kind of going by the definition that you know, television is now the most dominant kind of medium for storytelling. You can't really tell a story with episodic stuff as much as you can with serialized stuff. So
no, there's plenty of good shows that,
yeah, sure, but just like, you know, tonally, like, they might be unique, and that's something that Better Call Saul definitely would be. It would be really, really unique tonally, but I think there's obviously Vince Gilligan probably has an idea. And I mean, you can speculate about it all you want, but, you know, essentially he's not gonna, I wouldn't see him fucking it up too quickly. So, you know,
I mean, there's a lot else in this episode, but, like, right from the beginning, they're really saying, we've got a new character, and particularly because it's really important, like, obviously Saul satisfies a storytelling function, but on another level, there's a real sense that, he's making up for this newfound darkness. Like, the show's gotten so dark. Yeah, and absolutely.
And then whenever he's around, it's not even glossed over. It's just, we're in Saul land now.
Yeah, I know.
It's just complete and total change.
Immediately brings, like, a good energy to the show, just as the show's about to hit into its darkest territory. He brings, like, a really dark comic relief that doesn't feel like it's at odds at all with the rest of the show. The other thing in this episode is that we get more of the development with Skylar and Beneke, which we didn't actually mention last podcast, which was about a week ago. We forgot to mention, of course, that Skylar had returned to work for Beneke. And one of the things that I wanted to mention last week, but it's the same for this episode, you see it in both, is that Walt is very careful about not directly opposing her going to work. You can tell he's not entirely comfortable, but he doesn't do the obvious kind of Heisenberg thing, which is to say, no wife of mine has to work. No, he's quite accepting of it. He's fine. You know, he doesn't have a problem with Skylar earning money. I think, you know, what really annoys him more is the charity of the Schwartzes, or the charity site that we see later on. And the other thing that is big in this episode is that Jesse and Jane start fucking for reals, and we find out that she's a lapsed addict. And you see it more throughout the season, but in this episode already, I like the fact that Kristen Ritter's playing Jane as a reformed junkie and kind of actually finding a strength in that as opposed to a weakness. And like, oh, meth, oh no, oh, I can't. She's just kind of like, yeah, I'm a recovering drug addict. I've got to go. So I think that's actually, I forgot how strong she was in that role.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really interesting watching, like, she really goes through a pretty incredible arc.
Yeah, in only
six or seven episodes. Yeah. So the thing is, also, just I think obviously we kind of have to get to her, but, like, at this point, you know, she is strong and there isn't really any chink in the armor, but, like, you almost see the armor as, you know, just her being who she is rather than a facade. And that's what really attracts Jesse to her.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know,
and particularly when his main, what the main point of his life is Walt, who is the biggest bullshitter in the world.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's just a really, it's just, you know, Walt, that kind of really kind of certain kind of personality really needs a very distinct personality to kind of be temperate in a way. And that's really what Jane is and why she is so, like, she just works her way into your affection and your heart as a viewer pretty, pretty instantly.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that the watching Jane's entire trajectory, her entire journey for the second time, you are just squealing with just pain.
Well, it has like it has a literally tragic edge.
Yeah,
you know, and you know what's coming
every
and you're
step
like,
of the way. You're just like, oh, it's gonna get better from here, but then it's gonna get so much worse.
And you're not entirely sure where they're taking that character the first time, but watching it again, there's this sense of inevitability, which is really just kind of sad.
No, you literally see an explosion in the sky when you think of Jesse and Jane together, or just anything involving Jane. Like,
The other like subplot in this episode is also that we see the aftermath of Hank and El Paso, and he's kind of still showing a front to most people, but he is clearly suffering, and it's actually Walt, weirdly enough, that has to console him. Or that Marie asked to console him, which is nice, and it kind of sets up their relationship in season 4 when Hank's really badly injured. So it's interesting. But the main reason I wanted to bring up this subplot was you see a wedding photo of Hank and Marie, and he has this giant
Stetson hat. It's amazing.
So like he has one of those themed cowboy weddings. It just is perfect. Like.
And it's just the tiniest of moments. It's just 5 seconds on his desk.
It's a prop in the background. Like, they do not draw attention to it. The prop department would have just been like, we need a wedding photo. And it's so good. It's just kind of the attention to detail that's just like, ah, it's beautiful. But anyway, the centerpiece of this episode, of course, is at the end, is basically Walt and Jesse have to deal with Badger getting caught. And this has... ends in multiple... fantastic sequences. The first of which is when Walt goes to Saul disguised as Mr. Mayhew, basically barely saying anything and trying to say, but these are very desperate men. No talking. Listen, your son's going to get his sphincter resized to about yay big if you let him into prison. And then, so that goes on and Walt just tries to get him until he bribes him, at which case, you know, it's an insult to his integrity.
And that's also, because we were saying earlier that, like, Bryan Cranston is just about the most expressive actor you can think of. Like, you just look at him and, you know, and, like, you can watch him emote for hours on end.
Yeah.
And then... On the other end of the spectrum, Bob Odenkirk can crap on for hours on end.
Yeah.
So that first scene where they're just opposite each other and he's not doing anything and you're not really sure about who's holding sway, but then like you think like obviously because it's Bryan Cranston's show pretty much. Like you're just like, yeah, but at the same time, like this dude's in his first episode and he's doing all right.
The thing is also you kind of assume that because Bob Odenkirk's a comedian and a writer that he would be contributing dialogue, and recently at Comic-Con, there was a panel about Breaking Bad, and Bob Odenkirk specifically said that there is never a line of dialogue changed. Like, there's not a no improv policy on set, but he just says everything they write. And so, they write good Bob Odenkirk. But the other thing is, when they kidnap Saul, what I love is, first of all, it looks beautiful. They go at night, they drive him to the desert, and there's this orange glow that gives
it's a really nice symmetrical kind of shot.
It's just this beautiful look to the desert at night. And the other thing is we get the return of the pom-pom beanies, which just completely undermines how threatening they are. And I love just the first minute.
Of course, a callback to when they steal the methylamine.
Yeah, the callback to when they steal the methylamine in season one in that pathetic heist. But the thing I love is also that as soon as they get him, Saul just assumes they're someone else. So immediately, kind of know that Saul, this guy, gets around.
And the fact that when he's kidnapped and taken out to the desert in the middle of nowhere, he has an instant assumption about who's put a hit out on him. That's another reason to watch Better Call Saul.
Yeah, he's not... He's not... he's... He's upset, but he's not surprised. He's not surprised that he is being dragged to the desert. And then the whole thing, slowly he realizes how out of their depth they are and slowly turns the tables and becomes their legal representation. And then, of course, we get the whole thing with Mr. Kilkenny.
Kilkelly,
the fake Heisenberg, who they get Badger to identify as Heisenberg. Which involves this whole great scene of suspense where Walt has to distract Hank while Jesse tells Badger that he's sitting next to the wrong man. And it's like just one of those perfect, they do it, they make sure they don't have too many of these moments. They do it again very famously in season 3, but it's just where Hank and Walt's two goals just intersect and it's so close, yet Hank never suspects a thing.
And he's just like, and he just plays it so well. He plays it like, and this is the character type that he's kind of just playing off. Like, is that kind of pathetic but lovable buffoon?
You want me to go?
Of a father.
You want me to go? Like, or should I go? Should I back up? Or should I?
And he's like, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. I'll go. I'll go.
He spends about 5 minutes just saying what he should go, and Jesse just Badger, other dude.
I swear to God that the entire plot or like story of this episode just hangs on Badger being a complete moron.
Yes, you say there's less of a differentiation than
I don't maintain that.
Badger is the dumbest
Badger
of those
is
three.
The
Badger
dumbest.
Is by far the dumbest.
Yeah,
Skinny Pete and Combo,
more.
We can debate that. But Badger is the dumbest.
You just want to cuddle Skinny Pete and Combo? Like,
I know. Well, I don't know if I could physically cuddle Combo.
Oh, well, we'll get to that. Yeah, no. Anyway,
so the whole episode, just climaxes in this fantastic... I don't know what you describe it as, like, thrill action scene or...
Kind of just comedy thriller.
Yeah,
comedy thrills.
It just has this great sense of pacing and direction and atmosphere.
Direction, nice.
Direction. Yeah, some great direction there. And then, of course, but what's really important here is then we set up Saul as the fixer before we meet the literal fixer, Mike. But in general, like, the show becomes really reliant on kind of Saul to pull all these random dudes like Kilkelly and Mr. Disappear in season 4 and all these people. That becomes a really important sort of well for the show to mine later on. And it's introduced here. And then at the end, Saul says, you know, I can hook you up. I can be your sort of consigliere. And we get the start of... We kind of are moving towards Gus. And then, of course, next episode, it looks like Walt might cark it in 4 days out.
Oh, and a brilliant episode it is.
Yeah, I mean...
Michelle McLaren directing,
first time directing. And Michelle McLaren is kind of considered one of the series' best directors. She's directed this, she's directed 1 Minute in season 3, the episode where Hank gets shot. She directed the 5th season, mid-season finale... Gliding Overall, all really visually memorable episodes. But I want to just give the backstory on this episode. What happened was they wanted to direct a bottle episode. So basically this was meant to be like Fly. This was meant to be two characters in one set, very little money. It ended up being the most expensive episode of the entire season. because basically the shooting times needing to get the exact sunlight, it went massively ahead of... over schedule and over budget. But I think generally there was a little love lost because it was just such a beautiful episode and all those shots of the sunset.
And it's difficult to kind of talk about this episode in a way because it does feel like... It kind of feels like a bottle episode with a budget in a way, if you know what I mean.
I know, and that's what I thought. That's what I remembered this episode as. I remembered it as sort of like Fly 1.0. You know, it was a precursor to that episode.
Yeah.
It actually forwards the story a lot in that it's basically all resolves around whether or not Walt's cancer goes into remission.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of the story.
Yeah, and that's
forward.
The thing. Like, a lot of the time, a bottle episode can kind of feel like something which is kind of... It doesn't feel very story-oriented. It doesn't feel story-oriented. There you go.
I think, like, a bottle episode really is about taking stock of what you have and sort of... exploring the character relationships that are already there, digging deeper instead of moving forward, which is exactly what Fly does and sort of 51.
And Fly is an interesting kind of way of doing it because it, like, it's almost like a fly on the wall kind of
I did see the point of view shots too. Well done, Christian.
Okay, I'll shut up. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, so this episode, though, is all hinging on, you know, Walt. It's like it's a kind of a distillation of the series in a way because you've sort of got this whole thing. Now that I have a death sentence, I'm freer than I ever was. Because,
of course, he sees the massive, what he thinks is a massive tumor on the scan, which he isn't supposed to see through the window.
Yeah, which is turns out to be like the radiation.
Immunitis.
Yeah, I forget the exact term.
Immunitis or something.
Something much smaller. And essentially, so Walt goes on the biggest meth cooking binge of his life. Because he thinks he's going to die. And then, of course, the final punchline is that the cancer's in remission. He could very well live. And this has basically made all his actions up to this point so much worse.
Yeah. I think also just, I mean, to think about this episode as, like, exclusively taking place in the crystal ship It's kind of wrong because there is actually a
there's a lot of stuff kind of goes into it beforehand,
and like the phone conversation. Like I just really loved like the back and forth between Jesse and Walt. I mean, there are so many good examples of good writing, but in terms of like getting the that's one thing they do and why they do so well because you've got Walt who has a really really specific voice and Jesse who has a really specific voice, and that's why you know the introduction of Saul is so impressive, and just all these other characters, and Hank, and just everybody has their own really specific voice. But that's the thing. I think that's kind of why Saul is so impressive when he comes in, because, like, he's instantly...
He's just something you haven't seen in the show before,
exactly, and he's a really distinct kind of personality and vibe and something really funny.
Yeah.
So, you know, but the thing is, there's just a couple of, like, back and forths, like, between Walt... There's, like, Georgia O'Keefe, like, yeah, she does these, like, vagina pictures. I'm just like... Yeah, dude, we have to cook. Shut up. I don't care if you've got a girlfriend. Just, we're going cooking.
What's so hard about this episode now, watching it, when you know what happens is basically, like, how close they get over the course of the cook, and then knowing it all falls apart when Jesse leaves the keys in the ignition and then throws the water on the burning motor. But the whole thing, I mean, there's kind of, you can't talk about too much here. Yeah.
You can just talk about good moments.
But there's just lots of good moments, just a beautifully observed.
One of my favourite is, what are we building? You said it yourself.
A robot?
Actually, it's beautiful.
Which was actually improv. Really? Well, what happened was, the line was just, you said it yourself, a battery. And a crew guy on set, this was, I think, recently revealed at Comic-Con, and a crew guy on set went, oh, he should totally say a robot, and everyone was like, yeah, that's hilarious, and then the crew guy was like, yeah, we actually didn't really get that take, you might have to do it again, and so he tricked them into doing the take again with the line, a robot? So,
that's so awesome.
And then the other fantastic one is where he's talking about building this battery, and he's saying to Jesse, and what element would that be? And Jesse just stares for five minutes, wire!
Copper.
Jesse. Copper. So yeah, that's just so, like, there's so many funny interactions, even though this is more or less a pretty dramatic episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Because towards the end, you basically realise that, you know, Walt, the worst news Walt could hear at this time was, you have to live with yourself. And basically when he talks about all the bad shit he's done and that he deserves to die, it's just like...
It's kind of the beginning of that idea that you really see come out in Fly. What was the perfect moment to die?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and that's kind of like a really nice complementary kind of relationship between the two bottle episodes in inverted commas.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know. Definitely. I think there's this sense of kind of Walt taking stock of who he is and examining himself and asking, man, I'm just on this course that I can't get off and it just needs to be cut short. And it takes him ages to realize he can just kind of leave by his own... Well... Mm. Yeah, I mean, he leaves twice, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I just... And then, like, the final episode... The final scene where he punches the towel dispenser in the bathroom of the doctor's office or the doctor's practitioner or whatever. And he just punches it. And then you kind of see this distorted face of Walter staring back at him. And it's, there's kind of this sense that Walt has been...
Is that the end of Four Days Out? Shit.
Yeah, that's the end of 4 days out, is the you know, him destroying the paper towel dispenser in anger. And that's, of course, like, oh, you know, this is a horrible revelation for him. But beyond that, it's also kind of the reflection of him all distorted.
Oh, of course.
In the beat up metal.
It's kind of that thing that you know, you've got, he's looking at himself, and there's this tremendous kind of, there's a lot of kind of self-destructive kind of energy within Walter. And now that he also has that energy, that he is alive again, and he has to deal with surviving almost. So he just can't deal with it. And as a result of that, that is what brings into being the distorted figure in front of him, is that he can't really deal with survival and with himself.
And he basically, and I mean, that's the thing, he spends the next episode trying to figure out what he wants to do now. Although we should just mention before we move on that towel dispenser comes back, which sounds a bit weird. But anyway, in terms of the imagery of it, like, pay attention because it comes back in Gliding Overall.
Oh, yes.
When Walt goes for another scan, which a lot of people suggest means that he's got cancer back or something. We don't know going into the episodes whether or not he's got cancer. That's interesting. My other theory is that... Well, you know what? I'll just leave this. Like, we'll talk about Gliding Overall when we get there.
Yeah.
If we get there. Please let us get there.
Oh, I really hope we get there.
Anyway, so we then, season 2, episode 10.
Over,
which starts with another teddy bear flashback and a very heavy implication.
Mm. And I forgot about it.
Yeah, I forgot.
Not forgot about it, but didn't really kind of stick in my memory to kind of put two and two together. But there is a body, there are two body bags at the beginning of this cold open. And it kind of just took me a moment to go, Oh, shit.
Yeah, they would have been traveling through... Yeah, but the other thing is, the implication is that those huge dents in Walt's car from the plane crash that featured throughout season 3 are from bodies.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's...
And that's
dark.
And that's the thing. It is almost... It's very much in keeping with the theme of Breaking Bad, which is, you know, almost no mention made, like no kind of real acknowledgement of kind of what's... gone on or going on and kind of remaining a silent and, you know, separate and distant part of it. And that's the thing. There's only one moment. It's when he gets pulled over in season 3 where you've got this moment where he's like yelling at this police. It's like, I had body parts in my yard. And you're like,
oh yeah, he did. Fuck. He had body. That's kind
you're
of
like, I didn't see that. I kind of just, you know, let I my assume imagination
there was just a teddy
not.
Bear and a whole lot of symbolic guilt. But,
and his glasses fell off somewhere along the line.
So, essentially, Walt just spends this episode in a pissy, pissy mood. As he kind of lives with what basically can be described as a life sentence as opposed to a death sentence. It's an important step in the series because he's got to go, what do I do now? It's no longer about the cancer. I no longer have that excuse. Do I try and go back to this life with my, like, overbearing brother-in-law, my piss-weak son... Yeah.
Well, see, that's the thing. There's obviously that moment. This is the tequila moment.
Yeah,
where
the tequila. All
plies Walt Jr. or Flynn with three full cups of tequila in a row.
Three, I'd say there'd be like about double shots of tequila. So you'd say that there's about six shots of tequila, and he's 16. Yeah, like that adds up in my book.
And it happens pretty quickly.
But yeah,
the thing is, like, there's that whole kind of resentment where, you know, like Hank's kind of said to him in the past, like, if anything happens to you, you know that I'm going to be here for your family.
Yeah,
and
of
so
course,
he kind of senses
he usually
that closeness.
Just internalizes
that. And he really is kind of sensitive to that closeness, particularly between Hank and Walt Jr.
Yeah.
So kind of he's like, well, deal with it. I'm around now.
Yeah.
I'm your dad.
Drink
the
tequila.
Fucking tequila until you just put it everywhere. And what does he say? He says,
and when
bring the bottle back, my son.
This is my
bottle, my
house, my son. And, the party sequence is just, it's really rare, basically, particularly this early in the series, to see Walt so openly hostile at home. But I guess he just gets really pissed, as in drunk, and then gets really pissed, as in pissed off. And it's really kind of beautiful to watch. And you know how we talk about how Heisenberg doesn't come home very often.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's Heisenberg at home with Heisenberg time. Yeah. Which is funny because I thought, huh, that kind of sounds like...
That's another great spin-off idea.
Yeah, it sounds like a Home Improvement series. And of course, the episode then turns into literally Walter White's Home Improvement episode.
Now, don't give him 3 tequilas because that'll make you a monster. I'm just kidding. Give him all the tequila you want.
And yeah, so like, and also one of the, actually the darkest moment of this episode, I think, is when Walt, after Junior throws up and Hank kind of, he's just smirks to himself and sort of has this real distinctly Heisenbergian gloat going on that's really sickening and sort of worrying as what's going on at this point. When will he break?
And I think this is a really important episode. I feel like this is a real kind of turning point.
Well, yeah, it is.
Heisenberg-wise, because you really see it in terms of him relating to another person, which is, you know, it's all very well for Heisenberg to kind of be the entity that he kind of uses to kind of give himself some moral alibi for whatever it is he's doing.
Yeah.
But when he actually starts being the monster interpersonally, like particularly to his own son, that is when it really starts to kind of become something intense. But the fact is that that's also when you see him like with his smirk on his face. It's an expression it's so subtle. And you don't really see it in any other moments.
It's some amazing facial acting by Bryan Cranston.
That moment and the end of this, which we will get to, we've got a couple other things to kind of talk about first, but the very end of this episode is absolutely astounding.
I was reading this thing, I forget exactly where, I've been reading so much stuff about Breaking Bad lately, but there was basically this discussion of how Vince Gilligan, well, just the writers of Breaking Bad, they just... As the series went on, they cut and cut and cut their scripts until they're some of the shorter scripts in television, dialogue-wise, because they realised that Bryan Cranston can be so...
Expressive
that it's really in the show's best interest if you just let him sit back and do his thing.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so the thing else I love about this episode is basically after he's kind of sobered up and... is remorseful, he wants to make amends, and so he wants to show off his money. Now, usually in a show like this, when, you know, character gets a bit full of themselves, gets a lot of money, they usually buy a new car, which Walt does actually do when he goes really off the deep end. But in this episode, there's this fantastic little scene where he's buying a new water heater, and the whole thing is staged almost like it's a parody of that classic... of, you want a new car? Yeah, what about that one
money
over there?
Money isn't an issue. It's like going from like $30,000 to $200,000 cars. Instead, he's standing in front of water heaters.
Yeah, and the line is...
$400 to $1,200.
And the line is, and they play it just so broadly, but it works so well. He's kind of showed him the top line of, you know, what he thinks is in Walt's price range. And then Walt turns to him and goes, what about tankless? And the guy gives him this look like, I see you're a high roller, Mr. White. I love that whole sequence. And then he basically spends the rest of the episode doing...
Literally re-establishing the foundations of the family home.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a nice bit of symbolism. But also, we get the introduction of the crawl space.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's pretty good stuff. But, and just in this episode, from there on, you kind of just see this... It's a very kind of fatherly quality. It's randomly resourceful and at the same time a complete buffoon and a bumbling idiot. But like just at times, like he'll just absolutely slam a situation and just absolutely own it.
Also, the imagery, the fact that he's walking around the house in like a white plastic suit
with his gas mask on.
It's really like kind of the drug dealer has entered the house. I mean, that's, you know, obviously just one of the most kind of shocking things to watch.
If you were to see that out of context.
Yeah, if you were to see that out of context, just be like, what? He's cooking at home now.
And just like stopping by the breakfast table for like half a minute to just like...
To just
like
munch down some toast. His family looking terror and, you know...
But yeah, also when he's going to buy the tankless water heater, he literally takes out blood money as
well.
There's
money with a couple of blood smears on it. You know, he's just whipping out the hundreds and one of them has a stain of blood on them. You know, whoops!
Put that one away.
The other thing is the kind of relationship of Jesse and Jane progress. And it's interesting you kind of see it develop a bit more. So one of the things that I really like is they're starting to smoke in the house, which is a really nice nod to see that Art's slipping. She's kind of moving more, you know, she's given up on that rule, which was a big deal. And
And then we also, of course...
And we meet Donald Margolis, who becomes really important later on. And of course, he... But anyway, I guess the central thing is it's kind of their relationship progresses as we see Jesse showing her the comic book drawings, and it's all very sweet at this stage.
So sweet.
I feel like we're developing it, but we really get the happy days here, and it's kind of just sad watching it now, knowing what happens, but.
Because you've got three episodes after this one.
Yeah.
And then it just... That is absolutely...
No, two.
No, no. Wait, really? Yeah. No. There's Mandala, Phoenix, and ABQ.
She's not in ABQ.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
I know. You thought watching it was hard. We have to talk about it. We have to work through our pain together again.
But, you know...
The other thing is, because I'm really finding it hard to mention...
Kind of sounds like an NA, an NA motto, really.
Yeah.
BBA.
Yeah. I'm finding it hard to kind of keep on top of the Beneke storyline, because it really hasn't started cooking with gas yet. Just the one thing I will mention is that Beneke talks about to Skylar, you know, it's hard being that rock. It's just as hard as you. And I'm like, ha, well, take that, fans. So, I don't know. I thought that was a nice little meta comment on Skylar as a character. But anyway, the episode ends, of course, with one of the coolest moments.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, I know we've kind of, obviously, I have kind of, just even personally, have talked about how much I love the show up to this point. But when I was watching the first time, and watching it again, this moment is kind of really just confirms it. And it is almost... absolutely relentless from here on in. The moment when Walt is in the, I suppose for us it's a Bunnings warehouse. What is just like warehouse full of just
home improvement bullshit.
Home Depot.
That's what it's called in America.
And he's in there just buying some paint. Sees
a meth cook.
Just sees a trolley full of meth equipment and goes, wait a minute, like, it's just sitting here. Why is it sitting here? And then this bizarro Jesse just walks up with the pants and everything, and he just looks so...
That's what I love about this end, because you've got the bizarro Walt and Jesse. You've got this young punk kid, kind of skinny, pretty obviously users, and then you've got this kind of big, older, bald guy with a beard.
No, with a mustache.
With a mustache. Yeah. So you kind of get like...
With a limp caterpillar.
Yeah, but literally the bizarro Walt and Jesse, except you kind of... They appear harder as if they won't be intimidated.
And this is... But this moment is so important.
Well, we get that great TV on the radio
song. Oh, the TV on the radio song. What is it?
But where it clicks is, of course, is when he's at the cash register and you hear the dip,
DLZ.
Dip.
Yeah, and then...
Dip.
And then chucks the paint down and goes... Boom, boom,
yeah, but as it's beeping, you get a bump you in. Get it's kind of like... This dip,
classic Scorsese dip, bump in.
Beep.
It is the... You just really... That each one is just driving a nail further into the coffin of Walter White in a way. Because from there, from that moment, you see... You
something almost see click this, and he's like, nah, fuck it, I come
this. You see like his face as it's bumping in. You're like, is that Walter White or Heisenberg?
Yeah.
And then he just walks out, just goes straight up to him. And that, just that entire little sequence. And I mean, like, the thing is, the music is quite... loud, like, as far as music on a soundtrack goes, like, you're pretty much like, oh, well, this is just non-diegetic, it's kind of taken over the these kind of sound. And like, when you do hear sound, like, when you see the guy say that's him and everything, you're like, oh yeah, no, so the song's really kind of the focus here. When Walt speaks, when Heisenberg speaks and says, stay the hell out of my territory, his voice takes over,
yeah,
and it's this right up tight on his face, and it is just nothing but Heisenberg.
And then as they zoom, and then as the car drives away, the camera zooms in,
and you realize that Walter White has gone.
Well, I mean, in terms of say that a lot.
I know. Okay, fair point. Like, but the thing is, like, you really see this grotesque, like, the face he has at the end of that episode is... I think Bryan Cranston wouldn't have even seen that in his own face over like that is the character.
Yeah.
That is, you know...
I think essentially what this episode kind of is leading up to is that one of the fundamental premises of the show has literally been pulled out from under it, in that he has cancer, he's going to die, he does some bad things.
Yeah.
When he stops having cancer, there's kind of the whole thing freezes and you go, and he has to decide, and I guess the show as well has to decide, what do I do? And so he kind of, after this whole weird trip between getting pierced, going on the home improvement, he decides, no, I've come this far, I have to keep going, stay the hell out of my territory. Heisenberg, 2009, up you go.
It's kind of just, oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I think it's a really slow episode, but it's a really important one, because it just shifts us into, we're here to stay. Because, of course, next episode, we meet a little man by the name of Gustavo.
Right.
I was going to say, that guy who kind of...
We meet a couple of people in this episode.
Yeah, this may shock you.
We meet a couple of people in this
episode. Well, yeah, I mean, all right, well, let's start with the cold open.
Okay, episode 11, Mandala.
Yeah, where Combo gets shot. And the dudes who shoot him, I know you kind of know in your head that they're the same characters, same actors and everything. These are the guys that Walt kills at the end of season 3. Basically kickstarts his whole antagonistic relationship with Gus.
Is it the first person you see him kill? Because when he shoots the one who's shoots him in the head, just like as
no, you, the first person you see him kill is Crazy Eight.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh right. Yeah. But with a gun, maybe. I don't know. I don't know why that makes any difference. It doesn't. But you know,
it's
first one in a while.
No, it's the first time he's actively killed someone not in self-defense.
Yeah.
Arguably.
Well, that's the thing.
They all get worse.
It's all incremental.
Yeah, and it's like, when do you draw the line?
Yeah, exactly.
But we got a big line coming up in my... But that whole scene, basically, where the kid shoots him...
Oh, through the
way this scene is directed by Adam Bernstein is just incredible.
Adam Bernstein as well, who we should make mention of, because he comes back to direct some very important episodes. ABQ, which is coming up the end of this season, Half Measures... Which, of course, is the episode in which these two dudes get killed.
Yeah, that's true, actually. He introduces them and he kills them all.
And which is also the episode which begins with Wendy.
When Wendy Hester. Yeah, that's true.
And also directs... Oh, my God! I just realized something else. Because in this episode is the introduction of... What's-his-face? The guy, Gus Fring's kind of... main dude who kind of watches over them the entire time.
Yeah. No, it's not.
No. Yeah, no. It's the introduction of him. We haven't seen him before.
No, but isn't he... Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing. That guy, what's his name?
Do you know Victor?
Victor.
Victor dies
in Boxcutter. And Adam Bernstein directs
Boxcutter. Adam Bernstein gets to kill off all the characters he introduced.
Oh, wow, yeah, that's fun.
Wow, that's interesting.
We just realised that as we were talking. There we go.
Yeah,
that's fun.
Wow. Good work, son.
Good work.
I just want to point out, because we've been taking notes as we watch these, and my notes literally lead first dot point... Whoa. Second dot point. Adam Bernstein is pro. Anyway, so afterwards we get that call between Jesse and Walt. And, you know, Walt's like, oh, that's terrible. Which one was Combo again?
Oh,
you did not just say that.
Oh, it's so brutal.
And then you get this nice little speech from Skinny Pete essentially going like, this whole thing is not working out. And, you know, Walt in his sort of, in his comfy little suburban ivory tower doesn't realize that, you know, the people, the dealers on the street that die, like that is on his conscience, his incredibly flexible conscience. But yeah, it's just like already we're kind of getting the cost, but it just escalates from here. So then they go to, you know, the operations effectively shut down. They go to Saul, and Saul's going to put them in touch with a friend of a friend of a friend. And interestingly, we kind of worked out that, so Saul knows Gus through someone. And at the time you just kind of go, Saul has connections. But when we kind of reverse engineer this and think back, and like, it fits that the guy would be Mike. And of course this is before Mike as a character is conceived, but as the show developed and we find out Mike knows Saul and then Mike knows Gus, it's kind of like, oh yeah, that makes sense, you know? So one of Saul's private contractors is also sort of the top man of Gus Fring. So it's a nice little piece of continuity that retroactive
but it also makes
continuity.
It also makes it like, know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy. No, you don't. You know a guy who knows a guy.
I guess. I just, it's a nice piece of fan wank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not doubting that. But carrying on from what you're saying about how everything from here just kind of carries on, I think the most extreme example of that is the fact that we cut straight from this really kind of, you know, this tempest between Jane and Jesse, and we see her make the decision essentially at the door to relapse.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you cut straight into Chips in a Fryer, then Gus Fring, who we haven't been introduced to yet, and then Walt in the front of frame looking around for him. And you're just rewatching that going, oh okay, just give us a minute. No, relentless. Down. Okay, fine. I'm down with that.
Yeah, when Walt goes back to the restaurant to confront Gus, who he doesn't exactly know who he's looking for, the directing's beautiful because they frame Gus in this way so that he's kind of really small and he's below, you know, he's shot from above and he has that pleasant smile and
very
that quite...
diplomatic tone, that Mr.
very
White.
Diplomatic tone. And then when you cut back, the camera's leveled up, he looks much more imposing. We are not alike at all. You know, and immediately, like, everything has just changed. It's like, without changing a single bit, just through Esposito's acting and the framing, it's just like immediately he's become an entirely different person. And so, like, you already go, like, this guy, this isn't Tuco, this is someone who is just operating on another level. And, like, Gus, of course, Gus doesn't appear again in season two. This is the last we see of him in this season. And he kind of only slowly becomes a bigger part of season three.
But that's the thing is that, even without saying a whole lot, he is a presence and he is distinct. Yeah, and again, the voice is absolutely clear from the very first moment you meet him. And you're almost like, this guy couldn't be. But then you're just like, whoa, he is.
Yeah. And just, you know, obviously there's so
much.
No,
you do see him when he gives money. For
oh, yeah, of course. He comes back in the finale. Yeah, that's right.
Very, very briefly.
Yeah, but that is actually very important. So, yeah, I shouldn't have missed that. But Gus obviously just slowly and slowly, it kind of, you know, there's something so big about this guy, and slowly it kind of unravels about how sort of big and powerful and almost indestructible he is. So, like, his introduction, I think, is just pitch perfect in this episode. And the
Absolutely.
Other thing,
when Walt is in the doctor's room, I mean, you can kind of notice this all the time because it's Albuquerque, but there's just this one shot where it's just the doctor's office and then straight out the window is just desert. Mm. And I know you mentioned that like that had a lot to do with camera angle. And if you like put it anywhere else, you could see massive developments going on, which isn't surprising. The thing is like they put the camera in a position for a certain reason. And, you know, just like it kind of just really relocates it, like just like. Just a hospital or a doctor's practice just with a desert outside. You know, there's this something really...
This is a frontier doctor.
Like...
Yeah, I mean...
Even if, like, you know, there's nothing necessarily to kind of... Like, any decision for that to be a really specific thing. Like, when you're talking about somebody who's in a kind of personal abyss, to kind of just locate it in a desert, like... This was the first time that I feel like I had noticed it before, but the first time I was aware that I realized that Albuquerque was a very important place for
it's important for the show, and there's and kind of I think what sums it up is in going back is in Negro y Azul in the song they say now it looks like New Mexico is living up to its name, and that's kind of like what Albuquerque is. It's like it's like the place of the Western and the kind of and Mexico and all this American South American imagery that's so familiar in crime films and in Westerns, but it's sort of like it's the slightly lesser version of that. It's the step down. It's the Walter White of that imagery. But we're going to make this series, and just as we make Walter White seem quite imposing, we're going to turn Albuquerque and New Mexico into something that you've never quite seen before.
Yeah.
So I think New Mexico is the perfect place to set Breaking Bad because it just matches up with kind of the idea of, you know, something being something it's not.
And that's the thing about, you know, just even the whole Heisenberg idea that, you know, he's this particle moving in space and, like, while observing anything, you can never view it at any one moment because it's all becoming, it's never a pure moment of being. That's always in a state of change.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, that's kind of what the West, the idea of the West
is
about.
Yeah, it's that,
you know,
frontier of America theory.
The abyss, and there's all this kind of...
And it's nice that as they're filming, like, there's all this development going on in the desert around them that's kind of encroaching on these vast spaces that they want to shoot.
Just to go now for something completely different, there is this incredible, incredible moment when Skylar is singing to Ted. Happy Birthday, Mr. President.
We've been counting. We have a little thing going called Weird Breaking Bad Extras. So, you know what? Let's just leave this for the end because it's kind of its own little segment. So, but speaking of, this is the episode where we find out Ted's cooking the books, and I just want to mention that. We'll get into
Skylar's implicit criminality.
We'll get into that in more detail when that kind of becomes a huge plot point. I don't want to dwell on it at the moment. There's more important things.
Mm.
The episode, the kind of penultimate scene is Jane introducing Jesse to heroin and kind of the matter of fact, fatalistic way that Jane goes about preparing the heroin is just so sad to watch. And it's like, particularly she knows she's fucking herself up.
And it was only, what, like, the beginning of this episode that she was, you know, quite proudly 18 months going strong. Yeah. And that's the thing with a 45-minute runtime is that it's not quite a film, but, like, you think of the, like, you know, you think, oh, well, so, you know, there are so many stories to kind of serve that you can't really have an arc in one episode itself. But I mean, the thing is, like, you think about the kind of arcs that carry over movies in 90 minutes, but, you know, like, an arc, a lot of the time they aren't even believable, but this little arc for Jane is just pretty incredible and pretty devastating just in this episode alone.
Yeah.
You only need a couple of moments to kind of validate and inform, you know, a moment.
Yeah, and I mean, Kristen Ritter, she's really good in this season. I kind of forgot that she's not just sort of solid and good looking. Like, she's actually really brings a lot to that character.
And so much hinges, like, literally.
Yeah, it's a really important role.
Like, everything hinges on that. And she just really just nails it every time. And it's pretty fucking devastating. So, of course, you've got the moment, though, where Jesse does the heroin and is rising up off the bed with Enchanted by the Patters playing.
Yeah, that's such a kind of... Even though it seems sort of obvious, you know, when you kind of describe that scene to yourself and you think about it, like, when you see it, there's something so surreal about it to watch.
Yeah, it is a pretty incredible kind of moment. And it's almost like you feel like you've seen it done before, but...
Yeah.
Never, but I swear to God, I haven't seen that, though. So, I mean, while it
isn't there a similar thing in Trainspotting?
I think there might be.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
difficult to kind of say, but I think just, you know, in terms of, like, just, I think it's a pretty incredible moment. It's pretty standard.
Yeah, it's a really well-done moment. The other thing in this episode is Gus asks Walt straight up, why Jesse? Why this junkie? What is it? And he says, the reasons are because he does what I say and because I can trust him. And it's interesting in this kind of, in the third last episode, where really Walt is beginning to question, why does he care for Jesse? Does he care for him beyond a partner? Why is he so essential?
It isn't like he's the son he never had, so therefore...
It's something more complex. You can't quite work out what... It's more than teacher-student. It's not father and son.
I think, like, to me, in a lot of ways, he is almost kind of like a human kind of embodiment of the entire kind of quality that, like, Walt kind of gave up on something when it wasn't quite working. But even then, that isn't enough.
Yeah,
because
I mean,
he does commit so much time and effort and care to Jesse.
Yeah, I mean, you think of sort of that their history as, you know, as his student is really important. And I mean, it is, but there's more there. And I mean, it develops, we'll go into this because it comes up so much more throughout the series, but yeah, the relationship's really interesting, but we'll see that as it goes, because, of course, the final moment of the episode is this big frantic run as, you know, you've got...
He's been told that he's got 1 hour to get the 38 pounds by Victor in Los Pollos Hermanos. He's got an hour to collect the 38 pounds and drive it to a very specific location where he'll make the drop and receive his $1.2 million. But, of course, he can't get in contact with Jesse because Jesse and Jane are locked up all doped up in their house. So Walt has to break in and steal everything. And this entire thing is done with this relentless kind of chase music. And it's really that kind of involving. And it's almost this exhilarating, like, oh shit, come on, Walt, get all the shit together.
Just as it's all starting to come together, the text comes through.
And it's baby coming. And then he's just got this... No. It's just silent. It's just... And that's the thing. It's such an incredible moment, is that... And it really kind of confirms the idea that you've kind of almost been waiting to kind of see them make a judgment on it in a way. Because, you know, he's balancing being a family man with the modern kind of archetype of evil. And, you know, like, in being, like, a drug cook and dealer and, you know, eventually... emperor.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, where up until now, like, he's always been able to rationalize it and say, oh, you know, like, I've...
He's never had such a stark contrast between the two. Exactly. It's the most important moment of his life as a dealer, the most important moment of his life as a father. And he's really just, you know, he has to make a choice. Does he want to be Walter White or Heisenberg?
Yeah, exactly. And there's that moment where you kind of realize that you can't kind of rationalize it and kind of say that you can be both. It is one or the other in a way. And his alibi for family is his meth activity, and there's no buts about it, is that essentially in this moment, he kind of just has to just continue to get all this shit together and not pause and not think about it and continue to be Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, just kind of roaring off into the distance, like, to just get on with the job.
Yeah, so I mean... And
there's a really nice... In this, like, kind of moment, it's a moment of failure, not of achievement. Like, the real, like, you know, I've been working up to this for 2 seasons or however long it is. I've got a million... I'm nearly a millionaire. It's not a moment of achievement. It is a moment of failure. And
well, the thing is, you start the series, there's a baby on the way, Walt needs money. Here you are, it's a big moment. The baby's coming, you can get a lot of money. You can't do both.
Yeah.
So it feels like a lot is coming to fruition in one moment at the worst possible time.
And you're and there are 2 episodes left? That's not the finale hang? Like, wow, okay. Because it's almost like, for me up to this point, it's the biggest kind of distillation of just an idea. Like, yeah, straight out,
definitely.
Like, dear audience, here's the idea. Like, we're not going, ooh, what do you think about this? Like, ooh, is he good? Is he bad? Like, no, like, here, have this little nugget. But that's the thing, is that it isn't a finale, so it's not like, that's what we think, deal with that. It's like, we're going to play with this much longer.
Where does it go from here?
Yeah, exactly. But I also just really like the really nice hold on the out of focus kind of background of Jesse's, like, as he walks out the door, because you've also got, like, the whole kind of, like, almost a bomb under the table of knowing that, like, Jesse and Jane are kind of in there and, like, they're completely on their own path and everything. You don't even see them, but just, like, that's in your head. And then it just, of course, cuts to black with a door slam and executive producer against Vince Gilligan.
I know, which is kind of, like, increasingly as these episode endings get darker and darker, I'm just, like, see executive producer Vince Gilligan. I'm like, you arsehole!
You genius fucker! You fucker!
And then, of course...
We come to by the time we get to Phoenix,
we have season 2, episode 12.
Phoenix. Now this one.
Hi, my name is Saro. I watched Breaking Bad season 2, episode 12. Phoenix. I'm still alive.
Not that crazy.
I watched Phoenix. Haven't watched Phoenix in about 12 months. Got my 12 months relapse today. Yeah, but anyways, Phoenix effectively is, I think, it's a strong candidate for my favorite episode of the episode I consider the best. Favorite is not a word I'd use to describe
the best in terms of where it sits in the story, how it sits as its own standalone episode.
Well,
how it's
both
directed, the writing,
both.
The performances,
it's a crucial moment for the series, but also it's a brilliant episode in its own right. But the simple fact is, I think it's probably the most emotionally engaging.
Right, okay. I think there's, of course, the cold open for this episode is Walt making the drop.
Yeah.
And it's pretty interesting while also, like, calling up, he calls up Skylar, but he gets onto Marie and he's asking about his daughter while, you know, like, dragging 38 pounds of meth around. And it's interesting, the camera actually views him, like, almost from sniper viewpoints throughout this abandoned hotel, like they're through broken glass and like through, like, broken wire up the top, and you're just like, I know what you mean in emotionally engaging, but not quite sure why or what you're kind of being positioned to think.
Well, not this bit seems specifically, just the way it
builds. No, I know, but just in the way it kind of sets the tone for the rest of it, and of course the fact that this ends with the tire rolling off into the phone, which is a pretty incredible moment, and apparently took a very long time.
Yeah, I forget the details of it. I mean, you can see this in the Inside Breaking Bad podcast. It was a interesting story behind that shot. Look, the thing about this cold open in the episode as a whole is Phoenix is, I think, more than any other episode, and obviously that's key to the final moments of the previous episode, but in this episode, it's really dealing with the conflict between Walter the father and Walter the drug dealer. So the cold open is he gets the deal, he gets the money, then he goes sees his daughter, and it kind of slips into this domestic family drama again, and then we go home and he puts all the money stacks away, and then we get the titles, and then, you know, it all kicks in. So just this cold open, which is really kind of quite very subtle and very functional. It's already all about this very, these very sectioned off areas of Walt's life that are now directly conflicting with each other, of his dealing and his daughter. And also, I think there's a great line here, because of course Beneke just pops into frame when Walt arrives, is that when the baby's born, you know, Walt's so apologetic, but apart from anything, the word Skylar says is, "It couldn't have been better." Which kind of had this subtext of, "We didn't need you, Walt." I mean, she's not saying it in that way or anything.
Yeah, of course,
I mean,
but that's how it sounds.
But that it has this kind of feeling of he doesn't need to be there. Mm.
It smacks of independence.
Yeah, but
One, I think also another moment where he, you know, it's kind of interesting within the house. Like, he can't show himself truly to anybody, and he takes Holly. And he takes Holly into the room where he's got all the money hidden, and he goes, "Look at this. Look what your daddy did for you. I did this for you." And he just, it's just kind of...
And I mean, essentially his rationale. Like, it's the only way he can kind of, you know, he made the choice to not be there for the birth of his daughter. But it's like, oh no, it was for her. It was for her. I mean, you know, was it? Does he even still believe? I mean, look, we all know that that's not really the case. The question is, at this stage, does Walt still believe it? I think there's an argument that he kind of still believes that pretext. But
I think, you know, particularly around this stage, you really kind of start to see that a lot of the kind of things that Walt has used to rationalize what he's doing just kind of completely fall away from underneath his feet. And I think a really good example of this is in this episode when Jesse comes to his work, and there's this moment where I think he's slagging Jesse and your junkie girlfriend off repeatedly.
Yeah.
And he grabs a beaker and throws it at Walt, and it hits the periodic table behind them and just makes it fly up. So, you know, the one kind of pretense that they have for their association is chemistry, and then, you know, what, like, once that's gone, they're just kind of standing, they have nothing to say to each other, and they're just like, you know, what is this? It's almost, and it kind of comes back a bit later, like when Walt is of course talking to Donald, which is, I mean, we will, but you know, it's kind of talking about, like, you know, their family, you can't give up on them, like, there is a bond between Jesse and Walt. Maybe not that Jesse feels to a degree, but Walt obviously really feels.
Yeah.
To be beyond chemistry, but...
But I just...
It's almost the one thing that he has, like, rationalized, but feels something different for, which is really kind of true. Like, he does feel a bond to Jesse.
Yeah, I agree. There is this kind of thing, like, in spite of himself, he feels close to Jesse. But, I mean, I just... It's not so much... I don't know. Like, the whole like, great, you know, making the periodic table go up. It's just this image, and I don't think it really has any kind of particular, like, specific symbolic meaning. I just think it's kind of like this great little touch, like, "Jesse, you broke the chemistry!" I don't think it means too much. It's just kind of like...
Oh, yeah, I mean, you can read whatever you want to.
I just think it's a really nice
moment that just, like, fuck off chemistry, I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
But then essentially this episode, like, what I really like about it, it becomes a tale of two fathers, and that's really what I love. So we have Donald trying to save Jane, and then Walt learning to be there for Holly. And, like, the two stories are very separate.
And Jesse.
Yeah, and Jesse. And he's trying to save Jesse. And it's kind of like this conflicting relationship between, you know, his immediate family and then kind of his surrogate son. Mm. Which, of course, all comes to a head when they meet, when Donald and Walt meet in that bar. But it's just like, you know, you'll have, for instance, the constant reference to don't, like, put her on her side in case she spits up.
Holly. The foreshadowing
there is so... I mean, yeah, it's like, all right, so first of all, it's good, but then when you rewatch it, it's like, that's just really upsetting because it's just like this kind of... like,
kind of creates a parallel between, like...
Well, yeah, the vulnerability of Holly in that moment, you know, of, like, she, you know, can barely... She can't... If she throws up, she's not going to be able to do anything. She'll choke. And then that kind of transfers onto Jane at the end. It's just sad, you know?
Yeah,
There's something so tragic about it.
But, I mean, it's almost like a parent's... I mean, I'm 19, I don't have a kid, but it's kind of like a parent's view of things. Like, they'll always... in a way, like, be that kind of... almost be that innocent kind of being that needs a bit of help in the world. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, he does, you know... The symmetry matches up.
Yeah.
Like, so nicely.
I know what you mean. It is pretty distressing. Like, it is a pretty intense kind of moment. But, like, you're, like, having it in there, like, it's completely validated by what obviously happens later for Donald. Like,
oh, yeah, you know, I completely agree. And also the fact that, you know, Donald sort of... it's not this moment of sort of anger towards his daughter. It's kind of like, you know, it just sort of makes explicit this sense he gets, like, that she died in a way that sort of represented this failure to take care of her the same way that, you know, Walt and Skylar are trying to take care of Holly.
Yeah.
But the other, like, main thing that's introduced here is the Save Walter White website, which is symbolic of how kind of emasculated Walt feels and how much... And, you know, that's kind of like the inverse of what he shows to his daughter when he's like, look at what your daddy did for you.
Yeah.
And it also, of course, becomes a major plot point when Saul...
But yeah, absolutely. And there's so much of that, like, kind of Walt still... Obviously, we've only seen Walt as Walt White as the kind of completely emasculated, dominated, pathetic, dopey science teacher for, you know, like... a couple, like, not even a full episode, because he already makes the leap to become Heisenberg, or not to become Heisenberg, but to become a drug dealer and take some kind of control within the first episode. But the reality is that he would have been living like that for 20 years, you know, the thing is, he's lived with himself like that, and he knows himself to be just this kind of guy, this kind of pathetic guy who never really took the chances on himself that he should have. So the thing is that he's almost lashing out against a perception that he has of himself in so many ways. So he won't let anybody else view him as that, because that's the one thing he's really ashamed of, and he feels a need to be a shark.
Yeah.
You know?
But, I mean, this episode really... just one thing I want to touch in. I love the fact that Los Pollos enters the house when they get the takeaway from Los Pollos Hermanos, but that's just kind of a nice little touch, and it... is, I don't know, I guess you call it foreshadowing or just kind of... But I guess the climax it's all building up to, really, when Walt goes to buy the diapers and basically has to, you know, make the choice, after Jane's blackmailed them, give the money to Jesse. And as he's there, he kind of initially is doing it reluctantly to save his own ass, but then he realizes he really doesn't want to give Jesse the money because he doesn't want Jesse to piss it away into his veins.
You
can just see, basically, Jesse and Jane disintegrate as they have all these hopes and dreams, and it just slowly comes away.
Yeah,
even though it is hilarious when he says... Is New Zealand in Australia?
Yeah, that's like, they made Lord of the Rings.
You could just, like, paint the castles and shit.
It's kind of like...
It's hilarious,
you know, like,
but
it's
sad.
It's always kind of beautiful to kind of see people talking about pie-in-the-sky dreams and aspirations, but when you know they're never going to happen, it just kind of makes them... beautiful in the way that a dream's beautiful, because it's complete rubbish, but it's great.
But that's the great thing. They call it for what it is. Like, it is complete rubbish, because,
it's,
I mean, there are, like, the castles in New Zealand, you know.
The castles in New Zealand.
And, like, it's just
the ramblings of an idiot fool who you love, but, you know, it's kind of, like, it's really, you're almost chuckling, but just devastated also because you know that... Well, Jane's, like, you know, she's about to die, but just also on a couple points here, when Jane is blackmailing Walt, she says, national news, I'll bet. She's kind of, like, saying, like, this would be quite a news story. And I reckon, like anyone who's ever seen Breaking Bad, like, that's almost in their head immediately. Like, if you know, say it ended now, like, with a grand jury.
Yeah.
Like, just imagine that
the chemistry teacher
who became a multi-millionaire drug baron, like
yeah.
became the kingpin. you know, well, I suppose by the end of, like, season five, he is the kingpin, you know.
Well, I mean, in theory, he's retired, but we'll get there. The other thing I kind of want to point out was this very interesting little moment when Donald arrives at the house and is berating Jane and almost, you know, attacking Jesse. And, like, the framing is Jane and Donald fighting each other with Jesse in the middle, kind of looking at them.
Yeah.
And,
it's a really nice frame there.
Yeah, and Jane says to Donald, like, and that's what I need right now, judgment. And Jesse has this look of, oh, I know what that feels like, not just from his own parents, but obviously Walt. So then, and then again, you get this kind of nice parallel between Walt and Donald already, and you kind of feel like, oh, these two men are both kind of... Obviously, Donald comes across as a much more pleasant person than Walt, but, you know, they're both essentially looking out for the best interests of these people that they love. They don't know how to change them. They think they know better. And then when they meet, of course, Walt just outright says, you know, you think you know better, but of course you don't.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just like after they sort of spent their divergent parenting stories, they come together at that moment, just in that freak occurrence at the bar, and talk to each other. And it's just this really sad moment where, you know, Donald says, you know, oh, you know, any advice for a daughter? And he says, just love them for who they are. Yeah. And then it's like, well, he's going to kill your daughter in a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, also, there's that, they're drinking to water on Mars.
Yeah.
It's something like they're there, like two fathers, like with these really, really domestic, kind of mundane, but absolute issues. And they're kind of like, it's just a really funny moment.
Yeah,
there.
I mean, I want to just stop us here because I feel like if we try too hard to look into the water on Mars, we're just going to disappear up our own ass. But I just was thinking this, like, what is the point there? There's something poetic about it, but I don't know. But I'm just like, it just feels big. It feels like like, you know, they're talking about how they're on the cusp of something great. And essentially, like, both of these guys are in the middle. Walt's about to cross a line that's just going to send him hurtling into Say My Name territory. And Donald's life is literally about to be destroyed. So, like, it lends this colour to the scene. That's kind of like, everything feels a bit more epic without them having to explicitly say, like, I think our lives are about to change.
It is a frontier. And I mean, like, you know, It's a very different one. Like, that, I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about, but, like, the kind of common association is that, like, say, Mars, like, oh, that's big and that's so crazy, but the way they're talking about it, and particularly with the emotional weight, and I know what you're talking about with Phoenix having such an emotional weight as an episode, is that they're kind of talking about, you know, they're kind of talking about using Mars as a gas station as if it's like, oh, yeah, it's pretty... Ah, it could be interesting. Yeah. And then, you know, they talk about the reality of their families and their life. And it is this literally, well, they don't know it yet, but literally, well, Walt does, but literally life or death situation every day almost. And it kind of just shifts the priorities there in a big way. It's just not necessarily, I don't think the kind of water on Mars has to be a symbol or a metaphor for
anything.
No, it's
anything. Not.
I think it's just the tone that they approach that.
Yeah, exactly. It just makes the scene, like, it lends the scene a weight without, while still keeping it within the confines of what two people would realistically make small talk about.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's a really nice technique by the writers just to give it some extra gravitas.
But, yeah, no.
And then, of course, we should move this along.
Well, yeah, but, of course, he does... It kind of gives Walt the kick to go back to Jesse.
Yeah, because he's talking about this nephew that he finds, and he goes back to Jesse. And as he's trying to wake Jesse up, he knocks Jane over and watches her die.
And I mean, there are two things I want to talk about there. There's obviously, like, some kind of... Like, he knows that... It's almost... You can see the wheels turning in his head. You're not sure which ones, but you see the wheels turning in his head as it happens. But for me, I don't know. I don't know how much other people might think this, but for me, it's almost that thing of... You know, he's been dying, and he's kind of been that lamb almost. And it's almost like he will not survive knowing that anybody other than him has dragged him out of it.
Yeah.
And he would almost just, by virtue of his own pride, would hate for anybody to step in right now if that was him, almost, in a way.
Yeah.
And that is something that, you know, and I mean, he's talking about it. One really good moment for me is when he's talking about it to Saul. He's saying, like, cyber begging, like rattling a tin cup, and then like Saul kind of is like, no deep seated issues there.
Yeah.
And you know, it just really, this moment is the first, because I was just really thinking about that. That's almost what it is for me, is that, like, oh, like, I won't save her life. That's just, that's just charity. You've got to kind of look after yourself.
No.
But just let me finish. It's just kind of like that. It's his own kind of projection, and Walt is all projection pretty constantly. So that was just an idea in my head. Obviously, like, there's a lot else going on, but that's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty.
Yeah, I mean,
I just read that. I think
no, I don't read that at all. I think primarily what I think this moment is at. Well, oh look, like stating the obvious is just it's the line Walt crosses where he.
Yeah.
You know, obviously. And recently Bryan Cranston said, you know, when did Walt really cross the line? It was when he let Jane die, and I essentially agree. I think this is just where he kind of steps over a boundary that he can never come back from. He can,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And I don't think, like, even though there have been all these bad moments so far, it doesn't become a real serious thing until this happens. But the other thing I think is that it's still essentially Walt dealing in half measures.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an action. This is a moment of inaction.
Oh yeah, this inaction in its way is an action.
Yeah, exactly. So it's Walt. You know, it's murder through negligence. It's the whole thing of Walt trying to do these things without ever feeling culpable. It's just symbolic of kind of how destructive Walt is. He does all these nasty things without ever feeling like he is responsible.
Mm, absolutely.
So, I mean,
yeah.
The way that Jane dies.
Because he shakes Jesse, Jane falls over, and then he doesn't stop her from dying.
Exactly. You know, it's not that he kills her, and it's that he does. That, you know,
without him, it would not have happened, and he had an opportunity to save her. So, with it just in any, almost in any way that you look at it, apart from just in terms of the mens rea. In terms of, like, the guilty mind, it's all there. But in terms of actually carrying out the act of murder, it technically isn't.
Well, I mean, legally it's not. Yeah, I just think that it's this sense of, like, of Walt still
it's the grey area. It's the grey matter.
It's a half measure. Yeah, it's literally, exactly, you know, to take that. And that's what's so... When we get to next season is... In the arc in this season is Walt learning his actions have consequences. He can't just live this completely separate, detached... You know, he has... Yeah. He learns by episode's ends in a very literal, big-ass metaphor, actions have consequences.
Yeah.
And he spends the rest of the season... next season, season 3, learning about how he has to play the game actively. There are no half measures. So the key moment next season, the equivalent moment to what happens in Phoenix, is when he shoots those drug dealers, which is a moment of action. And you think that's crossing another line. But it's not so much that it's getting worse. I think that it's just...
It's, incrementally, the it's, extremity... And
it's
the
just the natural next step. It's just moving from this kind of hostile, you know, what the old Walter White, the inactive, half-measured Walter White would have done, to the proactive drug dealer. One isn't necessarily worse than the other. One is just more honest with himself.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we should probably move on from
we
that
should move,
final
yeah,
scene.
No, absolutely.
It's really distressing and kind of horrible.
ABQ is very much a continuation, very direct continuation of that. So... of course, we've got the cold open,
which reveals that something pretty big has gone down. That's affecting the entire area.
The first time we actually see plumes of smoke rising out of different areas
into the
of
desert,
Albuquerque,
yeah.
And we see that the entire street's been affected. And of course, it just kind of goes straight into Jesse. Is it straight into the springs on the bed?
Yeah. Well, after the credits, obviously.
After the credits,
into credits in the bed, and Jesse's just falling apart.
Mm. And we see. We just kind of focus on that for a moment. You just left to sit in that, and then we see Mike for the first time. And it's almost, it was like, whenever we've kind of been rewatching this season, kind of just seeing moments going like, ooh, yeah, awesome setup, callback, or whatever. Like, this was just like, yay, Mike.
That's the thing. Like, watching these back to back, it's kind of just, I know it sounds silly, but it's just like, oh, God, this is so, you know, really. It's really dark. It's really involving. Like, you've come, you know, it all sets it up in a way that has the most emotional impact.
Mm.
So that, yeah, as I said, Mike comes around. You're like, yay, Mike's here. Great.
Yeah.
But Jane's dead. Who fucking cares?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I kind of had the same reaction Jesse had. Oh, there's this big, scary guy here. Whoop-de-fucking-do.
Yeah, and it's almost like he comes in and he gives him a whack on the head and he says, like, I woke up, I found her, that's all I know. And he makes him say that and you just, like, look at Jesse's face and you're like, well, that's the fucking truth.
Who cares?
Just like...
He's
like, what the fuck happened? Like, you know, like, she's... And then he's just in this kind of, like... emotional just waste. He's in an emotional abyss. Like he's very much in the desert. He's kind of in the middle of nowhere. What that he goes to that house, and Walt comes to get him, and he just says, "I've killed her." And Jesse is just gone at this point.
Yeah. Another thing that's also really like about this episode I noticed is explains the title of the previous one, Phoenix, which I didn't get for ages why it was called Phoenix. Did you?
I still don't.
Yeah, I peeped it up this episode. Jane's birthplace is Phoenix. When he says, "Where was your daughter burned?"
Oh.
It was Phoenix. Yeah, so that episode.
Oh!
Yeah, because it's her birth and...
Oh, shit. Where everything begins, like, how far do you trace back a line until, you know, you've got somebody who's culpable?
No.
Or just like...
No, not that. It's obviously just, like, her death and Holly's birth.
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
Like,
okay.
It's not... Forget your big lines and... No, it's just Jane's birthplace contrasted with Holly's birth.
No, but just in terms of, like, you know... Okay, well, I mean, I'll kind of get to it. It's kind of a bit difficult to kind of talk about, like, the moments in this...
Well,
in
this... you know what? Like, I'm just going to make a big call. Like, let's just skip over most of the middle, because it's great, but it's its own thing, and I kind of think a lot of it's setting up for season three. It's great
in terms
the episode
of what exact scenes do you... Are you referring... Just
well, basically, what I want to get to focus to is... All right, so obviously, a lot of this arc is dealing with Jesse trying to pick up the pieces... Sorry, Walt... dealing with Jesse and putting him in rehab, and that's very interesting, but let's talk about that in season three, because that is where season three is going. What I really like about this episode is that, you know, this episode is about Walt learning actions have consequences, and obviously with Jane we had that, but where it's leading, of course, is that effectively he's going to cause this giant plane crash that is this huge visual metaphor for hellfire literally raining down on him. But what I liked is, and I never realized how kind of nice this felt as a season finale, apart from just the pink bear bookends, is that Skylar gives him that speech after she finds out, you know, all the shit he's gone through, and, like, basically, you know, outlines all these lies, and they're all lies that have happened through the season. So, like, there are all these callbacks to the Grey Matter stuff and the mother in 4 days out. So it's kind of like she just unpicks, you know, this web of lies that has just kind of basically been the foundation for this entire season. And then at the end, you know, it all comes out. I'm leaving you, get out. And another thing, of course, is he goes into surgery to get the cancer removed, and he comes out and he's Heisenberg. He's got the full beard. So, I mean, that's really nice.
Yeah, also, of course, we've got when essentially the first stitch is plucked out, of course, is when she says, "Have you brought your phone?" And he's completely doped up, and he says, "Which phone?"
Yeah.
Which he has just managed to smooth over and just managed to...
Restore some normalcy.
Exactly. So, you know, that's a pretty kind of... you kind of know it's all going to go downhill from there. But one thing I really, really want to talk about, and I kind of realized that watching this... kind of just these episodes back to back. And I mean, obviously I think we should get to maybe a couple other things, but just the point of view shot is something, because it is something that is pretty consistent throughout
the final one.
No, I'm talking about just like the repeated use of it, say like when Walt's going to like his money, just like all these moments where you've kind of got the camera looking directly out at them, and in between the camera and the actor or the character is say the money or the cooking or whatever it is. And I think probably the most famous, or just the one that sticks in my head the most, is when you've got the shot in the washing machine or the dryer, and Walt's getting all the money out of the dryer. It's in the first season, so you know it's a pretty immediate shot, and it's kind of it's kind of known now as the Breaking Bad shot. And I kind of was just thinking about that, you know,
or when they open the barrels of acid and they're looking
And in the fulminated mercury throwing shot. Is that so much of this, like just the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, is kind of about progress, and that within progress there is, or change, there is almost no way of viewing it as its own moment, and that is how the incremental kind of development kind of just occurs. But the thing is, with the point of view shot within the moment, you've got the moment judging you.
Yeah.
There is a morality for every kind of second and just every moment that you can't escape from. There is a reality, a decision, like people carrying out a deed. The deed can stare back at you. It can judge you. So there is no uncertainty, almost, in a way, is that you have to assess every moment. And so, I don't know, that's just something I read in that. So, yeah.
In a, as this relates to ABQ?
It's just kind of Breaking Bad generally.
Right, yeah, yeah, sure.
Because, well, I mean, it does carry on throughout the whole show. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, the thing that I wanted to, like, pick up on is that... So, apart from the... We really should have got his name, because he deserves praise, but, you know, Donald's acting throughout this entire episode is really heartbreaking, but there's a great shot where he's laying out the clothes for Jane, like, sort of on the bed, and he's kind of really in this trance. And then we do a cut from... the clothes laid out on the bed to Holly in the same pose as, you know, the clothes of dead Jane. So once again, they're still bringing in that parallel between Holly and Jane. Mm. And the other thing, and like, so while they're wrapping up season two, particularly with Skylar finding out the lie and the whole thing with Jane and sort of Walt realizing his actions have consequences. But the other thing is, we set up season three, and I've said sort of, they set up Jesse's arc in season three. They also, of course, set up that Gus is more involved than we think when he visits the DEA and drops a coin into, or drops a note into Walt's
donation box.
So, I mean, we really get the sense he's hiding in plain sight. And, I mean, we'll go into that more in season three. But, yeah, I think, look, so the ending of this episode, obviously, is the pink bear. The pink bear means there's a dead kid. Because the plane blew up. The plane blew up because Donald wasn't paying attention, because Jane's dead, because Walt didn't do anything. So, you know, obviously it's this whole chain reaction that Walt is responsible and the plane represents this. So, and I think basically, you know, we're talking last season, and I mean last season is in season one, all about how this is Walt changing. Mm. And that's true, and it's all about kind of the chemistry, you know, chemistry is the science of change and Walt changing. And I think this season... Yeah, obviously it's about that. The whole show's about that. The whole show's about Walt's change. But specifically this season, I think, is not so much about how Walt changes, but how Walt affects everyone else and how Walt changes other, you know, the events around him, and how he can't keep avoiding that. He has to take responsibility, which he doesn't by the end. They don't resolve that arc. He's still hiding from the facts, but...
And tying into that, which I think it mightn't seem like it ties in, but one thing that I noticed in Jane's room is that there's an Ouroboros snake. And you know the snake that eats its tail and kind of goes around to infinity? And that just kind of like tying into like the real cyclical nature of everything. For me, it's kind of almost, you know... like it's that whole everything is related, but in a different kind of way. It's a different permutation of the same idea. It's action, reaction, reaction. But you know, the thing is, I kind of see, you know,
come on, we got to wrap this up. Okay, Let's not do close readings of props in Jane's room.
Shut up. Plane crashes because Donald was depressed, which happened because Jane died, because Walt did nothing, because Jane vomited when she fell over when Walt shook Jesse, which happened because Walt went back to Jesse and Jane after hearing something from Donald. So, I mean, you can do that. And that's the point. You can go back as far back as you want. Like, you can go all the way back to Walt, like, scraping his knee when he's seven years old because, you know, like ultimately everything does result in something. It'll always come back to...
Exactly.
You know, and with a close group of people, like, there will be cycles and it will kind of come around and, like, go on its own different permutations, everything. And that's why I compared, like, use that idea, like, talking about Phoenix, is that, like, that's where it began. Ultimately, like, you can take it all the way back to there. Like, that's why the plane crash happened almost even. But I agree that your reading is better and correct. But, you know, if you you know, reading to kind of be taken in.
I mean, it's... The symbolism's quite... It's hell-raising down on Walt. It's not subtle, but it's brilliant. And I love the fact that they go... Because they... I mean, if they actually, like, did some huge, big, plot-heavy ending that would have kind of just... damaged the plot momentum, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been worse for the series overall. So I like that basically the end is sort of a thematic climax, more than a sort of big plot twist. And I like the end of this season more than season three, because I think season three, once you step back and just ignore Sun and kind of the intrigue of it, it's a cliffhanger and it doesn't kind of... It's not like we sort of end where we begin or anything. It just sort of... It's great, but it's not like... Whereas, of course, the end of season two just kind of is one complete story, and the final shot basically is the first shot.
And that ties back to the Ouroboros snake almost in a way.
Oh, like, you're like fucking Ouroboros snake. Really? Like, I want to edit that out. I mean,
all right, no, leave it alone.
I'll leave it in. But, anyway, we've got to stop this. I mean, season two, I think it's one of the best seasons.
after talking about it, I mean, inclined to agree, particularly the last four episodes. But there are four.
Yeah, the four. It picks up, but the whole thing, it's all based on that setup. And season two is, and that's what I mean. Like season two is all about it as a whole. It doesn't have as many kind of great episodes like 1 minute and half measures and box cutter. You know, it's all about this slow build to like absolute horror that is the end. And I still think that, barring maybe a few other moments, nothing is as emotionally affecting as the end with Jane and the plane and Dane and Kane and Maine. So anyway, let's talk about our awards.
Okay. Favorite moment in this season?
No, no, and it's right, the season now. We're not the whole season. It's the whole season. Favorite moment.
Best. Which one should we go with first? Cold open.
Well, let's start with best cold open.
Okay, I reckon my favorite cold open, probably because it was the moment that I kind of realized what kind of show I was watching, and also because it kind of kickstarts the entire rest of the show, is probably Combo's death.
Right, yeah, I think that's a great moment that's both well-directed and an important plot moment.
And also kind of took my breath away both times I've watched it. Also, special shout-out to the beginning of Better Call Saul with Badger on the on the bench. That's pretty great, too.
I think my favorite moment, my favorite cold open is still, it's got to be Negro Izzle, the black and blue Nakarito. I just think back to that. It's just so ballsy and out there, but it also just makes perfect sense. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, how'd you come up with that? I'm like, wow, that's just such efficient, smart writing. you know, it's just not weirdness for the sake of weirdness. It's brilliant. So favorite moment?
Favorite moment would probably still be Tortuga.
Right.
But possibly, when Walt gets the text message saying baby coming.
Right, yeah.
And then just that little thing on its own, just because it makes the transition, it kind of makes it really clear. But then also, that's
the thing. A great moment in the sense also the first time you watch, you're just like, oh, come on. They wouldn't do that. You know.
I think also, okay, I reckon I'll go with Water on Mars, actually. It's a pretty incredible scene, and it's so unlikely, but Because it's Breaking Bad, where, of course, Donald and Walt are talking in the bar. That's probably my season highlight, I reckon.
Yeah, I mean, favourite moment.
It's really difficult.
There's so many. I love Walt saying fuck you to Gretchen, because it's just on many levels, apart from it kind of being a bit satisfying. I don't know why I find it really satisfying.
Because he does.
And also just it's an important character moment. You know, I love so much of 4 Days Out. I could kind of list moments from that till the end of time. And then, of course, Tortuga. But I think I'm going to have to go in terms of best moments. And it's not my favourite, but it is the best, is when he lets Jane die. It's so important. It's so well staged. The look on Bryan Cranston's face.
But speaking of looks on Bryan Cranston's face, how about the end of DLZ where he says, stay the hell out of my territory as well?
That's a moment. Yeah,
that's a real moment.
Yeah, do you want to change that? You'll pick.
But no, actually, I don't know. I don't know.
You got to pick one.
Actually, no, I'll go with the plane crash because that was the moment I realised what the show was about
the plane crash is a good, and also like that whole thing of the shot of the bear falling in is just kind of amazing.
It also made me realise that this was a show that really had story, character, and theme completely interwoven, that you couldn't separate one from the other.
I know. I mean, like, I'm writing a 4,000 word essay on Jane's room.
Top three, Water on Mars.
No, one.
DLZ and the plane crash. Okay, I'll go with the plane crash.
All right, the plane crash. Yeah, I'm going to go with him letting her die. I don't like it, but it is the best, I think. It's the most important. It's probably the moment in Breaking Bad that made me the most affected. Definitely up at that point. It was the kind of when I went, I really care about this show.
Yeah. I knew he was going to let that happen before I even saw James.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I didn't. I found out about the plane crash.
I didn't.
All right. So yeah, in retrospect, I think Jane's death hit me the hardest.
Yeah.
Funniest moment.
Funniest moment. It's an extras moment, and it's I'm not quite sure which episode it's in. It's in Mandala. It's in episode 11, and it's
Skylar's singing Happy Birthday to Ted, and there's this extra in the background who just goes intermittently.
So depressed.
Just between shots, though. No, that's the thing. He looks really, really depressed, like as if his wife's just like passed away or something. And then the next shot, he's smiling and clapping.
No, but he looks really confused when he's it's like someone said, smile. Oh, if I have to.
Well, and then it cuts back to him and he's sad again. And then it cuts to like Skylar like singing to him, and then he's just confused. It is so beautiful. It's around 22:56 into 11.
Yeah, like
11.
Really,
it's
if you're rewatching the show, please look out for this. It is hilarious. You have to look out for him. The other thing I want to in that scene is there's just like, you know, they're kind of carrying on, and then this woman just says with such frantic, like kind of deranged menace, "Come on, guys, the wax is melting on the cake," and she looks like, you know, "I'm trying as hard as I can not to just stab everyone right now." Like, we just pissed ourselves laughing.
When... I also love, I think that's my favourite moment, but just, I think in terms of Saul, like, just Saul's entire, little, I think it's in Mandala, when he says, like, "Now I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, drug dealer's getting shot, it's been known to happen, now I'm going to come here with the home truth, boys. You two suck at peddling men." Yeah. And just that entire little bit.
That's your favourite intentional funny moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the best are, and I'm going to kind of cheat and combine two, but they're essentially like two halves of the same coin. One is, "We're going to build." "What are we going to build?" "You said it yourself. A robot?"
Yeah.
And then, same with that, you know. "What element, Jesse? Come on, you know this." Wire!
Speaking of two sides of the same coin in terms of the funny stakes, my funniest moment from season one was the beanie heist, and I think also possibly funniest moment intentionally funniest moment from season two is the beanie. What is it? It's like when they've got him like perched.
Yeah,
when
they've kidnapped Saul and they've got those beanies back on.
Just the beanies.
Yeah, I love those beanies. I hope they come back in the final episodes.
I love those beanies.
And all right, so most importantly, favorite episode.
You first.
Well, I'm gonna go Phoenix. I think it is just the most effective episode. It's subtle. It's not a flashy directed episode like a lot of my other favorites. Very subtle directing, but very competent directing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's more about the writing and the acting.
Colin Bucksy did that.
It's painful and it's dark and it's amazing.
I think it's pretty difficult to say anything other than the last three episodes, Mandala, Phoenix, or ABQ.
Well, hang on, Peekaboo. Going back and watching that can punch with the best of them.
Yeah, okay,
I'd probably
put
that as my second favourite.
Okay, I wouldn't. I think I'll go with...
And Four Days Out. That's...
And I mean, I kind of want to go with you on Phoenix, but I really want to go with either Mandala or ABQ because they're both directed by Adam Bernstein. And I think his contribution to the end of this season is so, so big that I think I just have to go with Mandala.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Mandala, lots happens in Mandala.
A lot happens in Mandala. Yeah. Like that we get the introduction of Gus, we get the introduction of like all these other... You know, and also I think I just remembered a funny. I don't know why I remembered this moment, but on the screensaver on Skylar's computer says Beneke Fabricators, which is just a really nice little moment.
Yeah,
like,
I mean that comes back because they're actually called irony of all ironies. They're actually called Beneke Fabricators. So every time you see that, it's a laugh. But yeah, I mean my favorite episode is Phoenix, and it's kind of up there with Peekaboo, 4 Days Out, and ABQ.
Mm. Yeah, I'll go with Mandala, just because it is that. Yeah, it is really, like, I feel
so
like it
11 and 12, respectively.
11 and 13 and 12, but I'll probably go 11 and 12, and then...
No, but I mean for each of us. So you're 11, I'm 12. So, obviously, and that's kind of what we're going with what we say. This season is a build. Yeah. It doesn't start bad or anything, but it's a build to a strong finish.
Mm.
Which is in stark contrast to season 3, kids, which we will be tackling soon. So look out for the exciting adventures of Walt and Jesse as Walt suffers guilt and denial and depression.
What are you doing?
I'm previewing the next season and Walt
irrelevant voice.
Further wrestles with his increasingly villainous behaviour. Gustavo Fring moves in on the DEA. Hank gets crippled. Skylar guilt trips Walt some more and begins an affair. And of course, we get the introduction of the creepy zombie cousins.
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's pretty good.
And apparently a fly pops up.
Apparently Adam Bernstein's doing some directing for the TV series Fargo coming up soon.
Yeah. Anyway, let's not get it too much. Anyway, we're going to not watch it now.
Yep.
But we will, and we'll be back with season 3. And I think, like, it's a bit tight, but I think we will be able to...
It's tight, yeah!
Finish this in time so that we get to the final 8 episodes in due season.
That was an Australian
joke. Yeah, to the Australian listeners, you know that one.
If you watch The Chaser.
Oh, that was a thing back in 2007. Anyway, we're off topic. So, thanks for listening and downloading and maybe subscribing. And hey, if you subscribe, if you're not subscribing, subscribe. If you are subscribing, awesome. If you like it, rate it on iTunes. I feel like such a tool doing it.
That was so convincing.
I know. we really would like it. Like, sincerely, I'd love it if you did it. I just feel like a dick asking for it.
We've just kind of been just ranting.
So disregard like, myself, my... false modesty and just fucking like us and shit.
It was self-aggrandizement. Just pretend it was and just go with that.
Yeah, and also you can email us and Cavaliers Do Television. Sorry, no. Email us at CavaliersDoCinema@gmail.com.
I really
hope visit the blog CavaliersDoCinema.blogspot.com or CavaliersDoTelevision.blogspot.com. Thank you very much for listening. And have a good one.